Holmesburg.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Holmesburg Prison tested more prisoners and more scientific protocols for more years than any other prison in the nation.
Acres of skin, human experiments at a Pennsylvania prison, a true story of abuse and exploitation in the name of medical science. Then, deadly deceits. The CIA does a report blasting its own Vietnam-era performance. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nigeria's opposition, upset over the appointment of the new military ruler, has called for a nationwide strike as a first step in a renewed campaign for democracy, 2 days after assuming power and a day after promising a return to civilian rule. General Abdusalam Abubakar appeared yesterday to be consolidating his power base in Africa's most populous nation. Two members of his inner circle were under house arrest in the capital. Nigeria's opposition movement, meanwhile, denounced Abubakar as nothing new and said it plans to challenge his appointment in court. The denunciations follow Abubakar's nationally televised speech on Tuesday night, in which he promised to proceed with the transition to civilian rule, but under the same plan as Sani Abacha, who is to be the only candidate, the general. Sani Abacha, of course, a general. Abubakar has given no details on how the transition would happen. This news from Indonesia, unhappy with the pace of change there. Some 4,000 university students staged a peaceful protest outside the parliament building in Jakarta, the students demanding that the former dictator Suharto be put on trial for corruption. Student organizers also say they want a people's committee set up to act as a new parliament ahead of general elections next year. These protests follow yesterday's when thousands of East Timorese, rejecting an offer of special status for their country, also called for the release of the rebel leader Shanana Gusmao from an Indonesian prison. Less than a week after Bishop Ruiz of Chiapas, Mexico, resigned as the chief negotiator between the government and the Zapatistas to protest the government's unwillingness to dialogue, Mexican government forces retook control of El Bosc, a municipality 25 miles north of San Cristobal de las Casas. 9 people were killed, including 6 that government officials said were Zapatistas and 1 police officer. No information was available about the other victims, whose deaths were announced late yesterday. A scientist testified South Africa's apartheid-era government plotted to poison Nelson Mandela in an attempt to inflict brain damage. Appearing before a panel probing apartheid crimes, Schalk van Rensburg described how his superior, André Immelman, told him of plans to give Mandela a drug which attacks the nervous system. The testimony was part of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission investigation of the former apartheid army's chemical and biological weapons projects. Van Rensburg said the aim was not to kill Mandela, but to disable him. Though there was no suggestion the plot was ever carried out, it was considered in the final years of Mandela's imprisonment, and at least for a short time after he was released, following 27 years of incarceration in 1990. This news from Wisconsin. In the biggest legal victory yet for the nation's school choice movement, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled yesterday that poor children in Milwaukee can attend religious schools at taxpayer expense. The 4-2 ruling allows the expansion of a landmark program that until now restricted participation to non-religious private schools. It would allow as many as 15,000 students, about 10 times the current number, to go to religious schools or other private schools under the same tax-funded program, which gives poor families roughly $5,000 a year for each child. It's the first school choice ruling by a state's highest court. School choice lawsuits are pending in Ohio, Arizona, Vermont, and Maine. Civil libertarians and teachers' unions yesterday blasted the ruling as a blow to public schools and said they would appeal. This news from Texas. Prosecutors said yesterday they'll probably seek the death penalty against the 3 white men charged with murder for allegedly chaining an African-American man to the back of a pickup truck and dragging him until the body was torn to pieces. District Attorney Guy James Gray said prosecutors are considering whether the evidence is strong enough to add a second felony charge, such as kidnapping, which would make it a capital punishment case. Gray said it's possible one of the men could be spared the capital murder charge if his testimony is needed against the others. Investigators said the men have ties to white supremacist groups, and at least two have tattoos of the Aryan Brotherhood, a racist prison gang. One carried a lighter engraved with an emblem of the Ku Klux Klan. The FBI is investigating to see if the three could be charged with violating Byrd's civil rights. Federal hate crimes can bring the death penalty. That crime took place in Jasper, Texas. And a former Klansman was jailed yesterday, a day after being photographed golfing, despite claims that he was too ill to be jailed in the 1966 firebombing death of an NAACP official. Last month, the judge had freed DeVore's Nix without bail after he showed up at a hearing in a wheelchair using an oxygen canister. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners. And I see you're appropriately dressed for the new environment here of a WBAI radio station here.
In what way is that? Am I wearing a uniform?
Yes, a Wall Street uniform.
Well, folks, that's right. This past week, we have moved down to Wall Street, and our new address is 120 Wall Street, where we'll be a fly on the wall, up against the wall, where we'll be, well, always there for you, watching those in power. Well, talking about those in power, we're going to turn first, before we go to an amazing story about prison experimentation, we're going to go to the CIA. This week, the CIA's own think tank released a study saying that top CIA officers during the Vietnam War manipulated information to suit the foreign policy objectives of Washington. The study was written by a retired CIA officer named Harold Ford and is based on previously classified and secret documents. The report shows how then CIA Director John McCone ignored the opinions of lower-level CIA officers and put, quote, heavy pressure on the CIA to, quote, produce a more optimistic national intelligence estimate for the president. According to the report, McCone also gave President Johnson a personal assessment that contradicted that of many of his officers on the ground in Vietnam and encouraged the White House to go big. Many of these officers were arguing against the consensus view in Washington that South Vietnam could be rescued only by committing U.S. combat forces in the South and systematically bombing North Vietnam. We're joined right now in our Washington studio by Ralph McGehee. He worked for the CIA for about a quarter of a century, wrote a book called Deadly Deceits. He's also compiled a database on the CIA called CIA Base, and he served in Vietnam in the early 1970s. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ralph McGehee.
Well, thank you.
So this report's come out. It's no surprise, I'm sure, to many, the idea that the CIA changed its intelligence reports to serve the political aims of Washington. But since you were on the ground in Vietnam, can you talk about what that was like as a CIA man there, what you were being pressured to do and how your reports were coming out?
Well, I think my particular case is a little bit unique, is in that I had a fairly wide appreciation of the nature of the war there. And when I went to Vietnam, I went and said, look, our reporting on Vietnam is false. We're not reporting what's really going on. And I had academic studies. I had my own operational experience in a nearby country. I had extensive background in Asian revolutionary work, and all of this was ignored. And I tried to sort of press my views. At one point, I became so depressed I contemplated suicide. But there was absolutely no way, and I'm probably presenting a little different perspective than Harold Ford is. There was no way for reality to be reported in CIA intelligence.
When you say that the viewpoint expressed then was wrong, what were some of the particular issues that you raised?
Well, the issue that I raised is there was absolutely no appreciation And in the book, Harold Ford's book, it's the same sort of appreciation. There's no use of Vietnamese sources, North Vietnamese or VC sources. All of the sourcing is based on American discussions, conferences, and all types of reporting. No use of the revolutionary writings by Ho Chi Minh, by Mao Zedong, by Vo Nguyen. And they had absolutely no appreciation for the war that was going on. They didn't at the time, and in Harold Ford's book, he still doesn't understand what was going on. I think if you recall in McNamara's book, he said our intelligence had no idea of the what was going on in Vietnam, no idea of the history of Vietnam, no idea of the commitment of the Vietnamese to the of the VC to a victory, no idea at all. And this continued throughout the war. I began protesting while I was in Vietnam about its false intelligence. It continued throughout the war, and it continues today, as evidenced by this study by Hal Ford. He does admit that there were distortions of intelligence, that there were efforts to pressure intelligence to be as it was, to be false, but his appreciation for this is so minuscule as to the reality of what was going on that it ends up being, in essence, an apology for CIA's performance during Vietnam.
Now, Ralph McGeehy, you dealt directly with Harold Ford, the CIA man.
Yes.
Who did the report that is now saying that the CIA blasted, or that the CIA was changing its on-the-ground reports from Vietnam.
I went to the Senate Intelligence Committee. I protested throughout the CIA. I went to the Inspector General, to the all sorts of channels within the agency, protesting our false intelligence on Vietnam. They had no impact. So I went to the Senate Intelligence Committee to protest, say, look, we're not reporting the truth about Vietnam, and who did I report to but Harold P. Ford? Harold Ford was a top officer in the CIA related to Vietnam, Vietnam's intelligence, and I did express my views to Ford, and of course they had no impact as far as I could see. But I believe Ford, and this is only an assumption on my part, I have talked to Sam Adams, who was another major protester of the CIA's bad intelligence, and he said that he had protested, and it's recorded in a book, his protest about the intelligence. He had protested constantly about the bad intelligence, but he had been warned about 30 times that if he didn't stop his disruptive activities, he would be fired. Well, I had the same experience. I had protested and was warned that my career would be ended if I didn't stop. So in this case, in Sam Adams' case, I believe he said, and this is only an assumption, I believe he said that he had protested to Harold Ford, and Harold Ford had threatened him.
Again, Harold Ford, the man who has now done this report. We are speaking with Ralph McGeehy, who is a former CIA agent for about a quarter of a century, and he did serve in Vietnam at the time that this CIA report is looking at, during the time of the Vietnam War, when Ralph McGeehy and others were being forced to change their reports to fit in with U.S. policy.
Well, for those of us who have observed the CIA activity over the decades, it appears that every time there is a Democratic administration in Washington, there are attempts to sort of review the most outrageous or problematical activities of the CIA. And then every time there's a Republican administration, there is an attempt to reinforce and reinvigorate some of its most nefarious activities. To what degree is this this back and forth between Republicans and Democrats? How did that affect the career officers in the CIA in terms of the kinds of assessments and the kinds of activities that they advanced within the agency?
It's difficult to put that into perspective. We had the case of President Johnson, who wanted to go big in Vietnam, and he pressured the intelligence to support his plans to introduce American troops into Vietnam. Prior to that, of course, it was the at one point it was the Eisenhower regime or administration, and that was during from what 58 to 60, and during that period there was tremendous operations conducted by the CIA around the world, the efforts to overthrow the Mossadegh in Iran, the overthrowing the government in Guatemala, and overthrowing governments just around the world. So during the Eisenhower administration, many, many operations were run around the world to create dictators, if you will, who were supportive of U.S. interests. I can't say that it was when Kennedy became president. He was a strong advocate of counterinsurgency and intelligence and in winning in Vietnam. So I don't see a tremendous difference there. And, of course, when Johnson became president, he was going to go big, and he was the one who insisted and avoided any experts who challenged us that we win in Vietnam. The order of battle controversy from 67 to 68 in the Tet Offensive, that sort of spanned the regimes of or the presidencies of Johnson and Nixon. So it's a little difficult to put it in the perspective of presidential situations.
But you did, we have had, for instance, during the years of the Jimmy Carter presidency, many of the same types of revelations that are occurring now under the Clinton administration of CIA excesses, of attempts to reform the agency's activities. Again, none of them really question why does our country need an intelligence apparatus spying on practically every country in the world, no matter how big or how small. But it does seem to me that there have been a back and forth, at least, between sort of what you might call more liberal and more conservative views of the agency's functions.
Well, I have been surprised this last year at all of the documents that have been released about the CIA. The Bay of Pigs report that was held secret since 1961, which claimed that probably demonstrated that the agency's Bay of Pigs operation was based on ignorance and arrogance and incompetence. You had that report. You have the reporting on the nuclear disaster in India, where the bombs were not detected.
But you also have the report that just came out that wasn't the CIA's own report, but Time CNN talking about the use of sarin gas to wipe out some camps in Laos, particularly targeted, it's believed, at U.S. defectors who were there. What do you make of that report?
Well, I believe it's true. Program in the magazine said they talked to, I think, something like 200 sources, a large number of them who were participated in the operation, and they described exactly what went on, that they did use sarin gas. They went into a village in Laos where it had been reported that American defectors were living, a number of American defectors. They didn't know how many. I think the estimates when it was 20 or 25. And this team that went in, the SOG team, a Special Operations Group team that went in, prior to it going into the village, they dropped gas, sarin gas, on the village. And when it was decided, and then the next morning, the team went in and killed about 100 people, just men, women, and children, and any round eyes, they call them, that they saw in the village. And then they tried to escape. The SOG team tried to escape, and they were coming under heavy attack. The team called in air support, and they dropped sarin gas on the attacking forces. And they said the attacking forces just keeled over and died. So I believe, from what I've seen, and I think it was Admiral Moore also confirmed, that this indeed did happen. Now, well, why all these...
On that note, we are going to have to wrap up. But I do want to give people a chance to find out about your CIA base, Ralph McGeehy, because rarely has a person from inside the agency put this much into gathering information about the agency from outside sources all over the world. Can you tell us how people can get in touch with you?
Yes, they can call me at 703-437-8487, or they can write me at CIA Base, Post Office Box 5022. That's in Herndon, Virginia, H-E-R-N-D-O-N, Virginia, 20172. I must say that the database is, to me, I use it every day, and I can find, you know, anything I want to find out about individuals, about countries, about activities, just about anything about the CIA. And I'm very pleased with it. I started it many, many years ago, but it seems to have progressed very well.
Well, thank you very much, Ralph McGeehy. Again, that number, 703-437-8487. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Ralph McGeehy, former CIA agent and author of the book Deadly Deceits. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Over the past few years, there have been numerous revelations about the role of the U.S. government in conducting scientific experiments on thousands of unwitting subjects, from the Tuskegee experiments, where hundreds of African-American men infected with syphilis were left uninformed and untreated by doctors who studied how the progression of the disease ravaged their bodies, to a diverse group of citizens around the country injected with plutonium, fed radioactive iodine, etc. This all now... released by the U.S. government itself and studies done by the Department of Energy. Well, today we're going to look yet again at a series of tests, but these are conducted over a 20-year period at a Pennsylvania prison. We turn to the author of a new book, Acres of Skin. In this disturbing expose, Alan Hornblum tells the story of Pennsylvania's Holmesburg Prison just outside of Philadelphia. From the early 50s through the mid-1970s, Holmesburg's prisoners were used in exchange for a few dollars as guinea pigs in a host of medical experiments. Hundreds of prisoners were used to test products from facial creams and skin moisturizers to perfumes, detergents, and anti-rash treatments. Other experiments used the prisoners as test subjects for far more hazardous, even potentially lethal substances, such as radioactive isotopes, dioxin, and chemical warfare agents. Based on in-depth interviews with dozens of prisoners, as well as the doctors and prison officials who performed and permitted these experiments, Hornblum paints a disturbing portrait of abuse, moral indifference, and greed. And central to this are the millions of dollars many of America's leading drug and consumer goods companies made available for the eager doctors seeking fame and fortune through their medical experiments. Over this next 40 minutes, you're just going to hear an amazing story. We'll speak with Alan Hornblum, who went to the prison to teach literacy there in the early 1970s, and we'll talk with some of the prisoners experimented on. We'll also be joined by a doctor who was there doing those experiments and then finally left. So let's begin with Alan Hornblum. Welcome to Democracy
Now! Good morning. Pleased to be with you, Amy.
Well, why don't you start? How you start in your book is how you came to the prison and what you first saw.
I had just graduated Villanova graduate school in 1971, and I decided that instead of going on for a PhD, that I would go into the prison system and do some work there for a while. And I started an adult literacy program in 1971. But the first day I walked into the institution, I saw dozens and dozens of inmates with bandages and gauze pads and adhesive tape on their chests, their arms, their backs, and I had never seen a clinical experiment before, so it shocked me. And the next day I asked the guard, what's with all these guys? Was it a gang war on the cell block? Was it a knife fight? And they said, oh, that's nothing. That's just a perfume study for the University of Pennsylvania. So I was dumbstruck by that, and being fairly skeptical, I continued to ask the guards and the inmates what was taking place here. And the inmates said they weren't particularly crazy about it, but it was the only way to make a buck in the prison. The guards said the inmates were absolutely crazy to offer themselves up as guinea pigs, but they were desperate for money. And that's basically what anybody knew during the course of the 3 years that remained when the program finally ended in 1974.
Well, of course, Holmesburg, I'm familiar with it because I was a reporter at the Philadelphia Daily News.
I recall you, Ron, from your days in the 400 North Broad Street.
Right. And of course, almost all of the inmates there were from Philadelphia. And it had been a prison with a lot of troubles over the years in terms of prisoner rebellions. And I'm amazed that all the time that, for instance, I was there as a reporter, none of us in the press had any awareness of this.
It's one of the fascinating aspects of this story, and that no one seemed to care. These were literally throwaway people, just the way they had retarded children at the Fresnel School in the Boston area used for radioactive isotope studies. The Wrentham School in Massachusetts, other facilities were using institutionalized senior citizens. The Tuskegee experiment ran for 40 years without the general public knowing. None of the doctors blew the whistle on it. Holmesburg is somewhat that sort of story, that the experiments ran from 1951 to 1974, and I believe there were more prisoners involved in more protocols for more years than any other facility like it in the nation. And even though there were periodically news stories that would come out generally favorable about these experiments in the early 60s, there was no investigative reporter, no politician, no prison activist who seemed to be sensitive to the fact that inmates were getting injected with radioactive isotopes, that the Army was in there doing chemical warfare studies, that all sorts of pharmaceutical companies were doing dangerous phase one studies. Nobody seemed to care. Those walls of the prison not only kept the prisoners in, but they kept the public out.
It is truly an amazing story. And the cover of your book, Acres of Skin, is a photograph of a man's back. And the only thing that would lead you to think it wasn't a knife fight is that it is systematically divided in a series of grids. This is the back of a black man, a black prisoner, that looks like a checkerboard. And in various places, gauze is laid out on this checkerboard.
That's what the inmates looked like. And that signified to me that it couldn't have been a knife fight. It was too symmetrical. But the prison was overwhelmingly minority-oriented. It was about 85% African-American when I walked in 71. The early years of the testing in the 50s, obviously, the demographics of the city and the prison system were overwhelmingly white. But as the city turned African-American, so did the prison system. And by the late 60s, the African-Americans were the bulk of the testing population.
Lay out for us who conducted these studies, and in terms of the university system at the University of Pennsylvania, and who were the corporations that they were working with?
The doctor who initiated the program and run roughshod over it for a quarter of a century was Dr. Albert Kligman, arguably the most famous dermatologist in the country. Many women know of him because of Retin-A and Renova. These are drugs that had their both place at Holmesburg Prison in the early 60s.
Retin-A, a lot of young people use to put on their face for acne.
It originally was an anti-acne cream, and in later years it became a very successful anti-wrinkle cream. But Dr. Kligman walked in 1951, and he did not see the individuals as people or as prisoners. He saw them, in his own words, as an anthropoid colony. He said he felt like a farmer seeing a fertile field for the first time. All of these people represented acres of skin that he could do dermatologic tests. The rudimentary tests were the initial ones in the early 50s, but by the mid-50s, Dr. Kligman's reputation and Penn's reputation as one of the finest dermatology schools in the country had it so that major corporations were coming to Kligman, to Penn, to Holmesburg to test their new products. We're talking about hair dyes, athlete's foot medication, diet drinks, deodorants, detergents, just about anything you have in your medicine cabinet. By the early 60s, you not only have phase one pharmacology tests taking place, but you also had major corporations coming in, such as R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, such as Dow Chemical Company. The Army was in there from 1963 well into the 1970s. So Holmesburg really became a supermarket of human research.
Now, Philadelphia also had several major drug companies. So were any of them directly involved?
I believe they were all involved. In fact, Pennsylvania had more prisons involved with prisoner testing than any other state in the nation. Most states in the post-war period did have at least one or two prisons involved. Pennsylvania had approximately 10, and that gets to, Juan, what you just said. Because of the top-notch medical schools in the area or the pharmaceutical companies, they all wanted to have test subjects, and prisoners were the guinea pigs of choice.
Well, we have on the phone with us several men who were tested. We have Leotis Jones on the line with us from Pennsylvania, who was in the prison at Holmesburg when these tests were going on. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yes. Hello. Good morning.
It's good to be with you. Can you tell us when you were at Holmesburg and what kind of test you were involved with?
Well, I was in Holmesburg during the early 60s. And some of the tests that I was on consisted of patch studies, such as what was described by Mr. Hornblum. Also, I was on a pill study. And I was on some sort of foot study. I had to put my foot under the light. I didn't have no idea what it was. That's about it that I can think of right now off the top of my head.
And how were you and the other inmates recruited for these studies? What were you told from the people who were conducting them?
Well, we were told that there was various tests that was being performed in the jails that offered inmates the opportunity to earn money. And, of course, we questioned how extreme the tests were, whether they were detrimental in any way, were there any side effects, you know, that could be of any threat to our health. And naturally, they told us no. We were told to sign a waiver, which we signed, how naive of us. And we religiously subjected ourselves to these studies for money.
How much money were they paying the inmates?
Well, some tests consisted of maybe $25. Like one particular patch test I was on was a study that consisted of a foreign germ. Just exactly what it was, I do not know. But this doctor was a little up front with me, a doctor by the name of Singh. And I asked him what was it. He said, well, it's a foreign germ. I said, from where? And you say foreign. He said, well, from India, you know. And he was from India himself. And so anyway, they just took some adhesive tape and stuck it on my my arm, my forearm, and kept sticking it and pulling it until they pulled off the first layer of skin. And then they put a liquid solution on it, and they put a gall and some, tape on it. And I walked around the prisons for maybe about a week or so, or just to come back, and they removed it. They it developed a cyst, and they offered to give me an additional $5 or $10 if I would allow them to lance it and put it in a tube, and they would send it back to the lab for further study. So naturally, I wanted it off, and they cut it off, and this is what they did. I was released from there, from court. I went to court, and I was released with a patch on my back. It was never a follow-up, and I didn't think that it was a threat. But a little later on, just to learn that I broke out into my skin pigmentation changed on my body, like around my buttocks and my back. I looked like a pinto pony. I did not associate it with the tests until later on when I began to get a little insight on some of the experiments that was happening, the effects that it took on other individuals.
We also have on the line with us David Price, who is another prisoner at Holmesburg. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Tell us when you were at the prison and what kind of experiment you were involved with.
I was in Holmesburg, June of 1961 to December of 61. I was on two studies. one in which they called deodorant test, and the other one was a sweat gland test, whereas they took a device and drilled underneath of my arm to break the skin and give me the solution in a tube. And then I put it on as you put on deodorant. And every 3 days I would go back and they would review it. The dust breaking out.
And how much money did you make?
That was for $50.
Why did you do it?
Because at the time I didn't have any monies on the books, you know, for commissary. You know, you wanted to do like the other men. They was walking around with brand new shoes on. You could order shoes at that time. You could buy watches. You know, you can have commissary. And during that period, it was relatively poor, and no money was coming in. Our people couldn't afford to send us money. So we subjected ourselves to these tests. And I was told that there wasn't any side effects on there. And I signed the consent form to such. And I was on a Colgate, I think it was a Colgate, tooth study where I brushed my teeth. And from the time that I was there, I didn't have any side effects from it. But over the years, all of my teeth came out. I only have 4 teeth of my own. The rest are partial, uplates.
Leotis Jones and David Price, what did the prison officials, the guards or the supervisors that you came in contact with, what were they telling you about this? Didn't they, any of them, question what was going on?
No, they didn't tell us anything. I mean, everybody was in their pocket. That's what it was. It was money being made there. It was an industry. Nobody cared what happened. It was just like that.
Well, Leotis Jones and David Price, we have on the line with us as well Dr. Bernard Ackerman. He is the leading dermatopathologist in this country, and he was a student under Dr. Kligman at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was one of those who was doing those tests on, well, people like you at the prison, perhaps even you. We welcome Dr. Bernard Ackerman to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Hi. Can you tell us when you came to the prison and what tests you conducted?
Yes, I was at the prison between 1966 and 1967 for 10 months. And my subject was dandruff, so that the only
dandruff
work that I did was on that particular subject. I did not participate in any others like deodorants or anything other than dandruff.
And what do you mean? What did you do to test dandruff?
Well, we did a variety of things. We did a host of studies, from microbiologic ones to biopsies to Scotch tape stripping of dandruff and looking at the bacteriologic flora. We counted the cell layers of the stratum corneum. We attacked the subject in what I thought was an academic way. I was a resident, a second-year resident. The academic part, which was my thrust, didn't justify what was done at Holmesburg. What was done at Holmesburg should not have been done, and no study should have been done there.
How did you reach that conclusion? Was it during the time that you were there, or subsequently, as you began to think about the experimentation program more?
Well, it began during the time that I was there, and then in the intervening years, it became more and more patent to me that it was completely wrong. But the first sense that I had for it was when my brother, who was then chairman of the Department of Orthodontics at the University of Pennsylvania, came to visit me at the prison and took one look and said, haven't you heard of the Nuremberg Code? And that prompted me to look at the code, and as a consequence, the experiments at Holmesburg were clearly in violation of it.
The Nuremberg Code saying?
I think, pardon, well, that there should be, for example, voluntary consent, informed consent, that one didn't do experiments on prisoners. I mean, this was clearly in violation of that code.
Dr. Bernard Ackerman, as you tell us what the Nuremberg Code is. We'll let people reflect on it for a minute as stations identify themselves, but we are going to come back to this conversation. It's an absolutely incredible story. It is the story of the Holmesburg Prison outside Philadelphia, and it is written up in a brand new book called Acres of Skin that's published by Routledge Press, Acres of Skin, Human Experiments at Holmesburg Prison, a true story of abuse and exploitation in the name of medical science. And it's written by Alan Hornblum, who didn't just have an academic interest in this. He had gone to the prison to teach literacy and saw men there being experimented on, and so has written this book over the last few decades. We're also joined on the line by Leotis Jones and David Price, two of the men who are at Holmesburg who were experimented on. We will be back with this discussion here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In 1 minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez and a whole roster of guests who are talking about the Holmesburg Prison, which actually is in the city of Philadelphia. And we're talking about the experiments that went on there from the 1950s through the 1970s. Alan Hornblum has written the book Acres of Skin, Human Experiments at Holmesburg Prison. On the line with us, two prisoners, Leotis Jones and David Price, who were prisoners during the time of the experiments and were experimented on, and Dr. Bernard Ackerman, who is a leading dermatopathologist in this country. He works at Jefferson Hospital and was a student under Dr. Kligman, the professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who headed up these experiments at the Holmesburg Prison. Now, Dr. Ackerman, you just cited to us the Nuremberg Code, talking about the fact that it says that you shouldn't, among other things, experiment on prisoners. Talk about what that meant to you as your brother talked to you about it.
It meant that there were examples of terrible advantage-taking and dehumanization of human beings in the previous two decades, beginning in Germany in the 20s, and proceeding to 1945. That was a model for how doctors should not behave. And the Nuremberg Code was a result of reflection about that terrible period in Germany, and was designed to prevent that from happening in any form to human beings any place, in any country.
So what did you say to Dr. Kligman when you came to this realization?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There was not much dialogue with Dr. Kligman. Dr. Kligman was not a person that one could have easy conversation with about matters such as this, because he felt very strongly about the importance of what he was doing. And as Mr. Jones pointed out, this was a very big industry. And so there were several reasons I didn't speak to Dr. Kligman about it, not the least of which was that my own thinking about it was evolving during the course of those months that I was there. And at the outset, Dr. Kligman had made it seem that this was a tremendous opportunity, not only for science, but also for the prisoners, that they were being compensated, etc. So I must confess that it took me some months before I came to the position that I did, that this wasn't right. And as I mentioned, as time has gone on during these intervening 30 years, the horror of it is much greater than it was then when I was still a resident.
I'd like to ask Alan Hornblum, You entered the prison in the early 1970s at the tail end of the experimentation period. Why has it taken this long now, practically 25 years, to be able to get this information out to the public?
Well, quite frankly, Juan, I always thought it would be somebody like yourself, an investigative journalist, who would be moved by this issue and crusade over it like I had to. Quite frankly, I always thought there would be a historian, a politician, an investigative reporter who would be as curious as I was and Bernie Ackerman was and really do the research and the writing of this. But by the early 90s, no one had done that, but I, like Bernie, could not get the vision of these experiments out of my brain, and I started to track individuals down in 1993, and I became so invested in the project that I left my position as the chief of staff at the Philadelphia Sheriff's Office and was going down the tubes of destitution until 5 years later. We now have acres of skin and pretty much the full story of what took place at Holmesburg, although Bernie Ackerman sometimes states that he thinks I only have the tip of the iceberg and there were many more experiments that had taken place there.
Well, in fact, Leotis Jones, you testified in Washington about these experiments. Is that right?
Yes, we did.
What year was that?
Alan Lawson, myself, and Bud Schofer went down to Washington to testify because of the fact that the fears that develop as a result of them becoming more and more extreme with their testing inside the prisons. I mean, not only was there testing in Holmesburg Prison, but they had designed a prison in Butner, North Carolina, that was called Butner Behavior Modification Research Center, to experiment on individuals that projected a certain type of behavior. You know, so I'm saying, like, you know, you had people that was beginning to become more and more extreme because of the fact that they had a total green light on this, and they had nobody to caution them. And there was very little publicity put out about it. Even after we went down to Washington to testify to have it stopped, and it was stopped.
And you testified before Congress in 1973.
Yes. There was no coverage whatsoever. If so, it was very small. Nobody knew anything about it. And what this book, Acres of Skin, does is it reopens that.
Well, it's amazing, as you say, that you testified back in 73, and of course, it's an indictment of the whole journalism profession that no reporters at the time picked up on that. And in slight defense of myself, I didn't start working in Philadelphia until 1978, so I was not a reporter in 1973 and would not have been aware of your testimony. But definitely, in Philadelphia, it was one of the top investigative newspapers in the country, the Philadelphia Inquirer, which won years after year Pulitzer Prizes for its investigations, including of, as I recall, the Roman Haas facility, which was not very far from Holmesburg Prison, the chemical facility, and they were able to do extensive report on that, but somehow totally ignored this amazing horror story that you and so many other inmates went through.
It was too much money.
I wanted to talk for a second about some more of these experiments because they really are quite astounding. And among the stories was the story of Al Zabala,
right?
Prisoner. Can you talk about what happened to him?
Well, Al Zabala came into the institution in 1963, and he was desperate for money, as most of the other prisoners were. And it should be pointed out that Holmesburg is a county facility where overwhelmingly the men are technically innocent. They are untried. They are waiting trial. So they were looking for money to make bail, to get an attorney, as Leota said, to go to the commissary, that to send to their wives and girlfriends. And the only way to make money in the prison was to offer yourself up as a guinea pig. Zabala first got a job, as he says, as a goon working in OBS, putting straitjackets on individuals who had mental problems. But he had friends who were working in the medical program, and they said, come with us, you'll make good money here. So he first started as an assistant, but the temptation to become a test subject was so great because the Army experiments came in at that time. The Army brought in three trailers. They put them between H block and G block, and they were paying big money, as the inmates would say, to take psychotropic drugs. And Zabala started taking these drugs. He had never been on drugs before that. He was anti-drug, but the need for money caused him to get involved in the experiment. But there are many others, and one of the most gruesome, I think, were the dioxin experiments, where in 1964, Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, had a problem at one of its warehouses where their factory workers were coming down with chloracne. The company shut down the plant, and they started to test the ears of rabbits with different items of this pesticide they were manufacturing, and they thought it was a byproduct called dioxin. But always with these companies, they wanted the real thing. They wanted human beings to test to see how they would react. So after the real guinea pigs, after the rabbits, they knew Dr. Kligman, they knew that Penn had this program at Holmesburg. They contracted with the physician, and they started to apply set amounts of dioxin. And to this date, I think it may be the only example whereby the scientific community purposely applied dioxin to people.
And what happened?
Well, the initial protocol was very modest. It was very conservative because the Dow company scientists said this is a very dangerous, toxic chemical, and the protocol came up negative. This apparently was very disquieting to Dr. Kligman, so on his own, he jacked up the dosage. He didn't increase it. He didn't double it. He didn't triple it. He didn't quadruple it. He increased the dosage 468 times so that it would almost guarantee that there would be chloracne. And what's also interesting is his action here was an affront to Dow Chemical scientists, where they severed their relationship with him.
Is Dr. Kligman alive today?
He is alive. He's 82 years old. He's quite affluent. He's professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's still considered one of the top dermatologists in the world.
And has the University of Pennsylvania, an Ivy League school, the pride of Philadelphia universities, ever apologized or taken responsibility for what it permitted?
I have never heard or seen an apology, and a number of reporters have beseeched them in recent weeks, as the book has been getting a lot of hearing in the media, to make a statement. And they're basically stating that the practice of medicine was different in the Cold War period, that our sense of ethics was not as developed then as it is now, and that's basically the excuse that they make.
Dr. Bernard Ackerman, well, you seemed to have objections then, if not at the beginning, as you moved into the study, and that was then. What are you doing in 1998 about these studies that you were a part of?
Well, I assisted Mr. Hornblum in his book, and had he not done the book, I was going to have the book done, and it was just happenstance that he found me and I him. I had no intention of not making this public information. I think that it was already said that the journalism profession should be indicted. Surely the medical profession certainly has to be indicted, because no one really took umbrage with this, and this was well known not only in Philadelphia but throughout the country. Dermatology really made a hero of Dr. Kligman. Furthermore, as has just been mentioned about the University of Pennsylvania, that an apology is in order, that what was done was improper. It is clearly a violation of the Nuremberg Code. There can be rationalizations, but no justification. And I think that it diminishes what academic life is supposed to be in this country if a well-known, prestigious university can't acknowledge the truth about its past. This is what one does when one is intellectually honest, and one has a sense of historical perspective, and one has a sense of responsibility to students. I think that they failed students like me by not having it made known then that this was wrong. This was glorified. It should not have been glorified then. It should not be glorified now, nor should it be excused.
Leotis Jones and David Price, what are you demanding right now as, well, being used as human guinea pigs in the experiments?
Well, one of the things that, you know, we are demanding, when I say we, I'm talking about the organization that I'm a part of, which is known as Community Assistance for Prisoners, is that individuals be compensated for the injustices that they were victims of, and also that there be an overall study or watch as far as their health and welfare go, and that of their offspring.
Are you suing?
I have sued back in 1980-something, 84, I believe it was.
And how were you compensated?
I was compensated financially, but it was, you know, really nothing to place what I was subjected to.
And David Price, how, in as the years have passed, how, and you've reflected on how this university and the prison system utilized you and so many thousands of other African Americans and other poor whites who were prisoners in Holmesburg at the time. How do you feel, and what's your sense of what this this tells you about our country and these kinds of stories that have never really gotten out to the general public?
It's very deceptive, you know. And this not only has it been going on today, it's been going on for years, you know, back in Tuskegee, that if people were totally aware of the consequences of what they were subjecting themselves to, I'm quite sure that they wouldn't participate. Now, even up to today, my back, as far as the pigmentation of my skin, I have moles all over my back and my face. I even have warts growing on my penis as a result of all of this stuff, you know. And when I have to go and make a defecation, I have warts up in my anal, you know. And I think that I feel as though I should be compensated. And I feel as though that my health, ongoing, there's no telling what's inside of my body as a result of this.
Have you been compensated in any way?
No, I haven't.
Have you sued?
No, I think that it's important to point out that the ethical issues... Yes, the ethical issues are clear. And some of the physical changes are clearly related to the studies, like hyperpigmentation, for sure. But then I think one must be cautious that not every single malady that a person develops in the course of a lifetime was consequent to these experiments, such as losing teeth, warts on genitalia, etc. I just want to caution that this in no way justifies what was done, but I just simply want to call attention to the fact that not every illness, not every physiological development, not every pathologic process be attributed to these experiments.
We just
Dr. Ackerman, this is Alan Hornblum again, and I think you're absolutely right, but let me read to you one 1958 study that inoculated scores of prisoners with such ectodermotropic viruses as wart virus, vaccinia, herpes simplex, and herpes zoster. The subjects of these experiments were healthy colored male volunteers, 20 to 45 years of age, who volunteered to be inoculated several times. In the wart virus section of the study, 47 inoculations were performed in 7 volunteers in different skin areas, including the palm, back, face, and penis. All of the recipients developed at least one lesion, some of them 2 lesions, at different localizations. This is in a Dr. Ackerman study.
Well, on that note, we do have to wrap up. It is an absolutely incredible story that we will continue to follow. The name of the book that documents the experiments at Holmesburg Prison is Acres of Skin, a true story of abuse and exploitation in the name of medical science. It's written by Alan Hornblum. It's published by Routledge Press. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director, and a very happy birthday to you, Errol. Michelle Garcia, our webmeister, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
How we break each other's hearts.